For the series A Book, A Thousand Stories, this is a review of John Suchet's The Last Waltz. Each episode is enriched by beautiful music selected by Gerald Fennec. The script is mine, Patricia Salomone. After the death of his brother and fellow musician Josef, a new and exciting opportunity was presented to Johann in the person of Patrick Sarsfield Gilmore, who was in charge of organizing the World's Peace Jubilee and International Music Festival for the summer of 1872 in Boston. We are told that everything about this festival was big. A huge Colosseum was to be built for it. The Johann Strauss Orchestra was to be the star. The United States market was a huge one, worth conquering. But Strauss was not keen to cross the Atlantic. His fear of illness and of death was so morbid an obsession that he wrote his will before starting the sea voyage. He feared the long train journeys and was terrified of being killed by the Red Indians. But Jetty encouraged him. She stood by him, acted as an experienced PR person, making sure that journalists knew that her husband was a knight of the Order of Franz Josef. The United States tour was a resounding success, but Strauss looked back with distaste and declared that he never would go back to the States again. And he never did. But taste and fashion evolve. And in Paris, Jacques Offenbach was becoming immensely popular with his operettas. While in the States, Gilbert and Sullivan were starting to make a name for themselves. Vienna's impresarios were looking to introducing this form of musical show to fill the theatres. They had already tried to entice Strauss to compose operetta, but he declined. Now, with Jetty at his side, he had no choice. Jetty was the one person who knew how to influence Johann Strauss, writes our author, who continues, Strauss respected his wife's business acumen. In 1868, he was working on an opera for the Weidner Theatre. His debut in the world of operetta had its ups and downs, until in 1873, Strauss began to write a comic piece based on a plot involving a lawyer exacting revenge on his financier friend. All but completed in 2 months, the famous Die Fledermaus, the Bat, was born. By the summer of 1873, with Alexander Gerardi in the role of Dr. Falke, the production was a triumph, soon to be staged across Europe, the Americas, and even in Australia. By the end of the century, surprisingly, none other than the serious, sensitive Gustav Mahler, as musical director of the traditional Vienna court opera, introduced the Fledermaus, this light-hearted operetta, into the repertoire. John Suchet writes, "Above all, it is fun. I have sat through an entire production with a smile from ear to ear that never fades." The launch of this operetta coincided with the opening of the World Exhibition in Vienna, following London and Paris. But this event was plagued by ill fortune, including an epidemic of cholera. The Viennese needed a happy message, the encouragement to still believe in their usual maxim that happy is he who is able to forget what he cannot change. Whatever happened is not your fault, it is beyond your control. This is exactly what the operetta offered them, with the famous song which says that it is the fault of champagne, and the remedy is champagne. So let's drink a toast to the King of Champagne. So now, so now, so now. All I want is champagne, champagne, champagne. All I want is champagne, what we all want. There's only one thing for champagne, for champagne, for champagne. And as
Vienna, so much associated with operetta, is not the place where this genre owes its origin, but it is Paris. In the popular mind, as I said, it is Jacques Offenbach, the German-born composer from Cologne, who is credited with the invention of the genre, but not quite so. A certain composer, singer and impresario by name of Florimond Rangeur, known professionally as Hervé, wrote a series of short one-act pieces, with vocal music and also including spoken dialogue. They were known as operettes or operettas, little operas, because of the length and originally of the limited vocal and orchestra resources. They slowly became popular with the Parisian public because of the comic and satirical plots. But the great impact of the genre was to Offenbach's credit. He had already established himself in Paris as a brilliant cellist and conductor. He longed to compose for the theatre, for which he had a natural genius, but he could not break into the Parisian establishment of light musical theatre. Hervé was the one who had already produced a few operettas, and Offenbach took advantage of the Paris Universal Exhibition of 1855 to attract a large public from among the locals and visitors to the exhibition. There were to be other composers of operetta, but it was Offenbach who broke through previous hurdles and obstacles to establish himself as the greatest French operetta composer. His first and still very durable Orphée aux Enfers, premiered in 1858, is considered as his first full-length classical operetta. He was to write dozens of operettas, very few of which failed to register success. Together with Orphée, his most popular stage works are La Belle Hélène, La Vie Parisienne, La Grande Duchesse de Gerolstein, and La Perichole. Offenbach also wanted to be recognized as a composer of serious music. In 1864, he wrote a serious opera called Die Rheinixen, or Rhine Fairies, performed in the following year in Vienna with many cuts. It was never performed again until a complete production was staged in 2002. Offenbach influenced Johann Strauss, but it is debated how much he directly influenced him. He met him for sure in Vienna in 1864, and surprisingly, even though he was encouraged to tackle operetta, Offenbach's works remained popular in Vienna, and it took until 1871 for Johann Strauss to complete one for himself. Strauss's nearest local rival in the genre was to be Franz von Suppé, who, with a series of initially popular operettas, now mainly remembered for the splendid overtures and occasional revivals, especially those of Boccaccio. Suppé's operettas are more directly influenced by Offenbach, but Strauss still owed a lot to the naturalized Frenchman. Johann Strauss wrote 3 incomplete and never staged operettas, and of the 15 complete operettas he wrote between 1871 and 97, 13 of them were premiered at the Theater an der Wien. The first one, Indigo und die 40 Räuber, was followed 2 years later by the Carnival in Rome, but his masterpiece is the Fledermaus, premiered in April 1874. This is not to minimize other very good operettas he wrote, such as Das Spitzentuch der Königin and Eine Nacht in Venedig, Der Zigeunerbaron, and others. The prestige and superb quality of the Fledermaus makes it the only operetta which is performed at the Wiener Staatsoper, usually during the Christmas season. With Suppé's death in 1895 and Strauss's in 1899, the first school of Viennese operetta was over.
The Fledermaus was to endure over time. More operettas were to issue from Johann Strauss's pen. He composed while standing at a tall desk in his home in Heitzing. But when he was working at Blind Man's Buff, Jetty suffered a heart attack and died on 8 April 1878. She was never to see the operetta completed, just as she was never to see the completion of the luxury mansion, the Stadtpalais in Egelgasse, which the couple were building and which was to replace their home in Heitzing. In 8 years, Johann Strauss had lost his mother, his brother, and his wife. Terrified as he was of death, Strauss even refused to attend his wife's funeral. It was his younger brother Edward who had the body taken away, arranged the funeral, and walked behind the coffin, and even dealt with all the formalities. This was reason enough for growing antagonism on Edward's part towards his elder brother. Besides, it was a known fact in Vienna that the Strauss marriage was on the rocks, and that the composer had a roving eye. In fact, not more than 7 weeks after Jetty's death, Johann Strauss married a young, pretty actress who had more looks than talent, Angelika Dittrich, known as Lily. John Suchet remarks, "Strauss's choice of a bride this time was as unfortunate as his first choice had been serendipitous." He tells us that Strauss was what we today would call a workaholic. He was decidedly not the man Lily thought she was taking on. She had anticipated a life of parties and champagne, but she had not anticipated Strauss's ferocious appetite for work. Thank you. The large reception room in the palais in which Strauss took his young bride to live received such famous people as Puccini, Brahms, Bruckner, names and lifestyles that were unfamiliar to Lily. That 25-year gap must have weighed on her very heavily. The marriage was further damaged by the fiasco of the next operetta, The Blind Man's Buff. The purchase of a country home away from the hustle and bustle of the city life at Schönau, southwest of Vienna, while proving beneficial to the composer, was not good for his wife. It was about this time that Lily started an affair with Franz Steiner of the Wien Theatre. Strauss tried to woo his wife back. He wrote pathetic letters until in November 1882, Strauss left Berlin, where he had been conducting an opera for Pest. He did not travel alone. Accompanying him was a widow, aged 26, 31 years his junior, by the name of Adele Strauss. Adele had known Johann Strauss for several years. When her husband died after 3 years of marriage, leaving her with a small child, she turned to the composer for comfort and advice. We are now at wife number 3, and Susha tells us it was an unlikely match. Yet Adele more than filled the void left by the previous wife. Johann was transformed. He began to dye his hair and moustache, and friends commented that he had shed years with the energy of a man half his age. He certainly was in love, almost daily writing his wife love notes. There were obstacles to their marriage. First of all, Johann was a Roman Catholic, and Adele was a Jew. This obstacle was overcome by her renouncing to her religion and taking on Protestantism. Besides, Johann could not marry her before obtaining a divorce from Lily. His request for a papal dispensation was refused, but then, as now, there is no religious law that cannot be bent with a little incentive mixed with a dose of hypocrisy. An old patron and admirer, Duke Ernst of Saxe-Coburg, had no qualms in accepting him as a citizen of Coburg. On 8th December 1885, Johann Strauss, Austrian citizen, Vienna's most revered composer, renounced his Austrian citizenship and on 24th June 1886 became a German citizen and had overcome all obstacles to marriage to Adele. Thank you. this stage, our author introduces the younger of the three Strauss brothers into the scene, Edouard, known as Der Schöne Edi. While Strauss enjoyed newly found serenity at home, he was to be troubled by this younger brother, handsome, assertive, and disliked by the members of the orchestra. Edi's ambition as a young man was to enter the diplomatic career, but his mother decided he had to study music and join the family music firm. This he dutifully did with success, for the family trait of a musical talent was not missing. He studied music theory, piano and violin, and, on his elder brother's insistence, specialized in the harp. Soon he was to compose his own music, composing literally hundreds of pieces in his lifetime. Between them, Johann Sr. and his three brothers composed around 2,000 numbered pieces. John Susha tells us not even the Bach family could rival that. Of the three brothers, while we can relate Johann Jr. and Joseph to the waltz, Edi was the master of the polka. His debut as conductor took place in 1862, when he was 27. He was enthusiastically received and, of course, compared to his two brothers. Here, perhaps, lies the seed of his brash character. Our author tells us he was always in the shadow of his elder brothers. He was something of a tyrant on the podium. He had a harsh tongue. In a few words, Edouard Strauss, excellent conductor though he may have been, was not well liked by his musicians, and he was certainly nowhere near as loved as his elder brother. Very bad, for Johann was averse to touring and Joseph died young, so taking the orchestra places fell on Edouard, who was resentful. Herein lies the tragedy of this musical family. Edi resented the preeminence of his elder brother. Furthermore, while Edi was feted wherever he went as a conductor, he estimated that in 23 years of touring, he visited 840 towns in two continents and gave concerts at 14 exhibitions. He was not as successful in getting his compositions published. He resented this, for he knew that this was important if his name was to go down to posterity. With Johann adverse to conducting, it was Edi who mostly conducted the Strauss Orchestra and faced the public. As a conductor, he was feted, and nowhere more than in Britain, where he played before Queen Victoria, as his father had done before him 50 years earlier. But always he was compared to his elder family members. This caused a brooding envy in him. Johann, being the elder and seeing himself as a sort of pater familias, wrote, "How old do you have to become before you realize that your brother is not your enemy?" Edward was always stylish, immaculately turned out. We have on page 163 an image of this handsome man who was so unhappy and had a tragic strain in him. Notwithstanding earning a fortune from conducting, notwithstanding the myriad medals and honors bestowed on him as a conductor, he was to end his life destitute, due to his wife Magdalena and his two sons, Johann and Joseph's profligacy. This, as we have already learnt, was to have a tragic consequence for the world of music. We will learn more about AD in later episodes, but in the coming episode of A Book, A Thousand Stories, The Last Waltz, we will be taken to another tragic family, that of Emperor Franz Joseph. Till then, my listeners, I thank my collaborators, Gerald Fennec, Albert Storace, and the Campus FM team.